Thank you, Nana, for the invitation. I'm afraid I'll be too long because I brought music, so I have to play it a little bit faster than usual. Oasis, okay. A couple of months ago, after performing at a jazz venue in Stuttgart, which I kind of demonstrated, sort of, an older man came to the band stage and he said that he liked the tunes on our website, but it angered him that tonight we were performing what he said minaret music. So, jazz musicians often get weird feedback, but in 20 years of performance, I have never came across minaret music. Metaphor is never innocent, Jacques Derrida noted once. I realized that the old man had to refer to tunes that were based on the Phrygian scale. I'm giving a workshop now. Ionian, and then the Phrygian would just be another tone. And this happens during improvisation, you know. Despite the fact that this scale has been used in Western music for centuries, the single note had obviously created an oriental association. And if you add an uneven meter, I can see how the old man would see himself confronted with Islamization. So it starts like this. An influx of refugees, and it turns like into this. Even meter, so this must have happened, and then it triggered something in him. So Wittgenstein wrote once that language always comes with a culture, and this applies sometimes to single notes as well, obviously. My point here is, of course, that this old man's slur in Stuttgart, where the anti-immigration AfD party is so successful, was no random event, but a more or less truth event, something real and revealing. A truth event always contains the trajectory of a possible future. In this case, I can envision a future law that prohibits the use of the Phrygian scale in Germany. And I can easily envision this man participating in a future war between Phrygians and Ionians. And if you think this is far-fetched or silly, I may remind you of Richard Wagner's book, Judaism in Music, from 1851. That contains all the necessary parameters of the Third Reich expressed solely in musical terms. Or take a visual example. One of the first post-war European anti-Islamization protests took place in an illustration for the cover of a Belgrade magazine in 1982. A well-known right-wing artist portrayed his nation of Serbs who are taking it to the street and protesting the Islamic infiltration of Serbian language. This is not about Oriental notes, but about letters that had migrated to Slav language via Ottoman occupation. True to the old man, we could call them minaret letters. Of course, back then in socialist Yugoslavia, the illustration was ridiculed and banned. However, 10 years later, it became realpolitik. You see, if only music existed in the world, the symbolic border regime could be reduced to a single note or letter. In other words, radical politics starts with the slightest of symbolic interventions long before violence and death occur, simply because violence and death are ubiquitous, are around us all the time. Since music is the most immediate art form, as Schopenhauer once put it, it is most likely to allure people to fall for the identity trap. As a jazz musician, you look at scales and cultures in an egalitarian manner. Very much similar to serial music, in which all musical parameters have equal rights. In other words, improvising is about a fundamental detachment of identity from the technique of expressing it. The political right, however, sees no difference between expression and identity. This is why nationalists like to think of themselves as direct representatives of the will of the people, and this is why they are imagining huge crowds of supporters where there are none. The Kulturkampf attitude completely ignores the universal musical structure that makes cultural distinctions possible in the first place. So in this context, improvisation as symbolic form structurally mirrors the phenomenon of migration by expanding the creative horizon and entangling the cultural, political, and economic relations. It is, so to speak, a phenomenon on the move that has concerned scholarship for a long time. And I'm glad to be surrounded by migration scholars, because I'm not a migration scholar. And I like to quote my colleagues here. As Kim Rigilf points out, it enables us to examine how notions of identity, community, and politics are negotiated in and through movement. It enables us to understand the contingency of citizenship itself. Brigitta Kuster notices similarly that migrating is a concrete challenge to our understanding of citizenship. The person on the journey is never the same in the end. Sandro Mezzata similarly speaks of, quote, the persistent turbulence, autonomy, stubbornness of migration, its ungovernable moments of freedom and excess. To me, these sentences sound could equally describe a free jazz album of the 60s. And I think it's not really, I just found out about it yesterday. The next conference will be about free music. It exactly addresses the issue. So it could have been one conference, actually. Also, think about it that I would assume that 99% of publicly broadcasted music is non-improvised. So I don't want to romanticize migration. I only want to point out that the structural understanding of what improvisation means refers to the very questioning of the political substance of all identity regimes as such. It is already the migrating of symbolic forms alone that tells us a lot about the circumstances of cultural production, the creation of historical value, and the according national sentiments and policies. Example, the 2003 documentary, Whose is the Song?, traces the origins of a traditional folk melody across several countries of Southern East Europe, including Serbia, Bulgaria, Albania, Greece, Turkey, etc. Each of the locals interviewed in the film claim that the melody originates in their country. It turns out, however, that the melody has migrated so much that its origin is lost forever, and with it, the national self-assertion. The song was first recorded in the USA in 1924 by klezmer clarinetist Naftule Brandwein. There are later recordings by Stella Lee and Eartha Kitt. Boney M's Rasputin features a similar melody, by the way. And there exists even a Bengali adaptation from the Indian poet Kazi Nazrul Islam. Yet, what does this example of cultural appropriation prove beyond the obvious? As I have shown in my previous work, many national narratives steal or adopt from each other, eagles and symbols and so on. This also applies to representative state symbols such as anthems. Haydn's motif for the Kaiserlied, for example, is loosely based on a Slavic folk song that makes up today's German national anthem. Israel's Hatikva is based on an Italian Renaissance motif that Smetana appropriated for his famous orchestral piece, The Moldau, you know. Quicker. So, between 1871 and 1918, the Kaiserreich have used the British anthem God Save the King as the German anthem. Liechtenstein still use the British anthem. And extravagant former Rhodesia used Ludwig van Beethoven's Ode an die Freude as their anthem, and so on. A Western invention, the overwhelming majority of world anthems stick to the traditional marching rhythm with its typical 2/4 meter, and independently of the cultural background. You could easily swap the Saudi Arabic anthem with the Austrian anthem, or the South Korean anthem with the German anthem, and it would make no difference in terms of decorum. It would certainly hurt feelings, but there is nothing that could not be reappropriated in national terms. I cannot read this. Because, to paraphrase Marx, not only workers, but also power has no homeland. The uniformity of national form neatly follows the uniformity of global capitalist symbolism, simply because the nation is a global container format of capital, if you will, or an ideal reflection of the real abstract equivalence of the commodity form. This means, for example, there's no comeback or backlash of nationalism because it never went away. And it means that you can read from the musical structure how much a symbolic form is indebted to a capital form. No. Not surprisingly, today's biggest pop hits, too, never use uneven meters, and harmonically they often accord to 18th century minuets with cadences rarely exceeding tonic, subdominant, and dominant chords. Dominant chord instabilities are always resolved in the tonic. The sound needs to be affirmative, neatly packaged, and readily consumed without any resistance. Recent German attempts at turning patriotism into music also accord to this. Take the German anti-Islamic Pegida movement's anthem, for example, which has only one tonic and dominant chord transposition. Or take Nena's album Made in Germany that follows all pop parameters of nation branding, a sales strategy that has become popular since the 2006 Football World Cup. Whether racist, xenophobic, or liberal attachment to the nation, many forms accord to what could be called pop nationalism, the use of popular culture for national display. Michael Billig has used the term banal nationalism to describe more broadly the daily material flaggings of ideology, with Althusser, ideology is always material, of course. The question, what comes after nations, therefore must address this endemic nationalist structure, because its material manifestations are everywhere, as the commodity form is. I would assume that it is impossible to be really anti-system of any kind if you stick to the given vocabulary and given chords, so to speak. Musically speaking, any concert at an avant-garde jazz venue in Berlin is more radical and anti-Western than ISIS. There's a reason why the Jacobins unraveled the entire calendar system and introduced a secular religion, and why 20th century avant-gardists abolished representation. So, I'm following Sandro here. There's on one hand a reified uniformity of symbolic expressions, and on the other hand, incommensurable cultural differences that are permanently celebrated or fought out. This constellation is not as clear-cut, it creates a range of confusions. Oh. So, everything could have been so easy. Since 1983, the annus mirabilis of nationalism studies, we know what nations are and what they are not. Ernest Gellner provided a typology of nationalism-inducing and nationalism-thwarting situations. Anthony Smith focused on the mechanisms of bonding between members of a nation. Benedict Anderson focused on the social imagining of national identity in accord with the evolution of printing press capitalism. And the Marxist scholar Eric Hobsbawm introduced a similarly popular concept with his analysis of how long durée notions are, as a matter of fact, based on recent policy. As Ernest Renan put it once, getting its history wrong is part of being a nation. And this triggers also Althusser's notion that ideology has somehow no history. It's always already there. However, it seems to me that not only getting the history wrong, but getting everything wrong is part of the ideological mapping of today. And this is what I would call a symbolic disorder or idiotism. Recently, for example, during the opening ceremony of the US Open, an official sang the German anthem but used lyrics associated with the Nazi era. In a display of defiance, the female German team countered with the official version of the anthem, a kind of Casablancian moment. You know, Marseillaise over the Nazi guys. After this incident, the organizer apologized, of course, and the German team was heralded by the press for symbolically withstanding revisionism, right-wing ideology, and so on. Of course, this completely misses the point. The tennis team did not take a stance against anything, but was simply trying to be correctly nationalistic. This is what, by the way, liberal capitalism critique looks like, too. People who claim to be anti-capitalist very often only want to be correctly capitalistic. The confusion about this scandal was enhanced in the aftermath. German player Andrea Petkovic, who had fled with her family from the Bosnian War in the 90s, exclaimed in all seriousness that the anthem mix-up was, quote, the worst thing that happened to me in my entire life. Ironically, she was bashed in right-wing forums for not having the license to be that hurt in her feelings since she was a migrant. So, despite being integrated in Germany, perhaps even too integrated for my taste, the right doesn't want her to be that patriotic. There must be an emotional border between real Germans and fake Germans. So, to get this straight, we have a former Bosnian refugee that fled from nationalist wars, a decade later engaged in an embarrassingly nationalist rhetoric, for which she is even criticized by German nationalists, who feel they are the only ones allowed to, by Mother Nature, to lay claim on what constitutes a national scandal. How are we supposed to have a rational discussion about this? The confusion applies to the far left as well, by the way. In an attempt to fight the gentrification of Berlin-Kreuzberg, a bunch of radical leftists recently demolished the front of an American-owned restaurant that they saw as a symbol for a new influx of investors. A graffiti stated, "Filthy rich foreigners out." If you are a poor foreigner, it applies refugees welcome. But if you are rich, then out with you. This segregation of foreigners in good and bad ones is traditionally a right-wing trade. I know this from my own immigrant biography in the Bavarian province, hallelujah, which, like today, had a confusing twist. Provided that foreigners are generally not welcome in the first place, if they come, they at least must be poor, so the Germans who help them can feel good about it. So my point is, these are not just isolated things. The battles for rationality are fought out irrationally, in and beyond academia. As Ernesto Laclau puts it in his book Populist Reason, quote, the dislocations inherent to social relations are deeper than in the past. So categories that synthesized past social experience are becoming increasingly obsolete, end of quote. Laclau is right, but the struggle for new categories seems never-ending and is part of the pseudo-political battles that we are facing sometimes today. Matthew Poole speaks of an idiot paradigm, a rule of rulelessness according to which anything can be claimed about anything with any signifier attached to it only if it suits your ego. This appears to be the consequence of what Christopher Lush in the 70s has once called the culture of narcissism. Meaning, everybody has his or her personal ideology, leading today to online extravaganza like, for example, black femme supremacy or esoteric techno-fascism. Sandro Mezzada refers more generally to a zone of indistinction, where the very boundaries between economy, politics, and culture are continuously worked and reworked, end of quote. Marx has addressed a conceptual blindness when speaking of idiotismus des Bürgertums, idiotism of the bourgeoisie. A century later, Heidegger defined what he called planetarism as idiotism, Well, I'm getting confused. Which he saw in a context with a global takeover of technique and a general indifference of identity signifiers. Remarkably and perversely, at the height of Nazi-occupied Europe, making Heidegger one of the first victims of his own idiocy. However, it is exactly this indifference that the current far right profits from when they abduct traditional leftist talking points, becoming proponents of anti-capitalism, even feminism, secularism, even gay rights. While at the same time, some liberal or left scholarship keeps on demonizing the Enlightenment, drifting slowly away into particularist reason that Adorno has understood to be one of the foundations of fascism. A recent Jacobin article points out how, quote, the frameworks of liberal identity politics and alt-right white nationalism are proving curiously compatible, end of quote. In other words, how the liberal left and right-wing populists converge on the question of culture and identity. So to conclude, despite unimaginable death counts at the borders in the Mediterranean, it is astonishing to me how much of the immigration discourse of the last years has become also purely symbolic or intensely symbolic. The areas, say, in eastern Germany with the most right-wing protests have the fewest, if any, immigrants. Yet to the protesters, the German nation seems at stake when a bus with asylum seekers enters a village, or when three buses are erected in midst of Dresden as a reminiscence to the Syrian war. Or even when I play my freaking scale, yeah? So this challenge must be understood dialectically. National imagination needs the other, the foreign, the alien, for its emotional fulfilling. Or musically speaking, it needs to hear those strange oriental notes in order to be aroused by the old marches and their traditional 2/4 meter. So, conclude, what did I say to the old man when he approached us? I said, you're welcome. Thank you.